We've all felt left out. And for people who move to this country, that feeling lasts more than a moment. We can change that. Learn how at belongingbeginswithus.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council.
From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen tells Congress that banks are safe and sound and the economy is doing well. But can anyone really believe that, given recent bank failures and the latest emergency rescue of First Republic Bank? Also, French drug giant Sanofi says it will cut the price of some of its insulin products in the U.S. by as much as 78%, the latest pharma player to bow to political pressure. But what's the real story on insulin prices? Welcome to Potomac Watch. I'm Kim Strassel, and I'm joined today by colleagues who are going to give you sterling answers to those questions, Alicia Finley and Kate Batchelder-Odell. Let's start with the landscape, as it were, out there in bank world, and Thursday's news that a consortium of some of America's biggest banks dumped $30 billion into First Republic in an effort to shore up that San Francisco bank. This comes, obviously, after the failures of Silicon Valley Bank and Signature Bank. But notably, Alicia, it also comes after First Republic tapped an emergency lending facility at the Fed and tapped a $70 billion liquidity lifeline from JP Morgan over the weekend, and it still wasn't enough. Can you tell us, Alicia, a little bit more about the specific issues that are facing First Republic? How are they the same or different from what we saw at those other two banks? And is this going to stabilize the entity, or are we going to see this to continue rippling through to other banks?
What's interesting is that First Republic has some of the same problems as the other banks when you saw its Signature and Silicon Valley Bank, but also Silvergate, which is known to be more of a crypto-concentrated bank. But some of the issues that it faces are different. So one similarity is it faces duration risk. It piled into kind of long-term, long-dated assets that with yielded higher interest rates when interest rates were zero. But now that interest rates are rising, those bonds that it holds or securities in its portfolio, it has to sell those at a loss if it needs to create liquidity for depositors. So one difference, though, is Silicon Valley Bank was mostly invested in government bonds like treasuries and mortgage-backed securities. Now, these can be very easily liquidated, even though they may actually end up taking a loss. By contrast, most of First Republic's investment portfolio, which was actually only 15% of its assets, were in municipal bonds. Now, these are very thinly traded on the secondary market. Most are held by U.S. households or mutual funds. So what that means is when First Republic has liquidity crunch, it couldn't easily liquidate any assets to meet these redemptions. And the Fed doesn't accept municipal bonds or most municipal bonds as collateral for its new emergency facility. So this seems to explain why it needed the $70 billion liquidity lifeline that JP Morgan and some others offered over the weekend, which $70 billion is huge because that's essentially one third of its assets. But what's troubling, should be sending out, you know, red flags for a lot of investors, is that that still wasn't enough, which suggests that there isn't just a liquidity problem. There may be a solvency problem. I took a look at its investor report, and well, yeah, there are some issues in terms of its very concentrated investment in commercial and residential real estate, and especially in these coastal areas, New York, San Francisco, Boston, and LA, where it does most of its business. And you are seeing the commercial real estate loans are starting to default. Mortgages are starting to default in these areas. And not only that, what's also worrisome is its residential mortgage portfolio, which include a lot of adjustable rate, you know, mortgages, the same kind of mortgages that actually got banks into trouble before the 2008 crisis, right? Adjustable rates. So when the rates start to rise and the mortgage rates have more, you know, doubled essentially in the last year, all of a sudden these homeowners are on the hook. Some of these are $1 million, $2 million homes, and they're all of a sudden on the hook. Payments have increased by $1,000 or $2,000. And it's not clear if these have started to go into default and there are foreclosures, But there's a huge risk out there that, you know, we're seeing these layoffs in these coastal areas, especially in Silicon Valley, and that they're going to have to start taking losses on their loan book, which could be why it needed this huge capital infusion.
Yeah. So the bottom line, if I'm hearing you right, is that interest rates strike again. You know, in the case of Silicon Valley Bank, they were in a lot of sovereign debt as interest rates went up. Their bond portfolios became less valuable. Here, you've got a bank that's, as you say, very invested in mortgages, loans, real estate. And as interest rates are going up, that's making them more dicey. And the thing that's stunning to me as I watch all this is that nothing here is like an exotic financial instrument, nothing off a balance sheet that was hidden. This is sort of straightforward stuff that they're invested in. And yet no one seems to have considered the possibility that interest rates would skyrocket and that this would have such a huge effect. And apparently, Kate, not even the government. And in fact, if you listen, the administration is currently doing all it can to calm investors and depositors. And that included what was meant to be some soothing testimony by Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen in front of the Senate Finance Committee on Thursday. Let's listen to a clip of her.
I can reassure the members of the committee that our banking system is sound and that Americans can feel confident that their deposits will be there when they need them. This week's actions demonstrate our resolute commitment to ensure that our financial system remains strong and that depositors' savings remain safe.
So, Kate, we're getting this sales pitch. According to Yellen and to President Biden, there's nothing to see here. Banks are sound. Economy's fine. By the way, they also mentioned we're going to get inflation in check. And yet, obviously, this comes after the government felt compelled to bail out these other banks, is now racing to stem this First Republic problem. I saw that First Republic took another bath on the stock market again today, despite these efforts. How do you rate what the feds have done so far? And is anybody out there buying the Treasury Secretary's claims, whether that be the market or whether it be people who are banking or whether it be her fellow politicians in D.C.?
Yeah, Kim, I mean, I think the answer is pretty clear from the markets today that investors aren't buying what she's saying. The Dow lost about 418 points, 1.3%. The S&P slid about 1%, a little bit more, and the NASDAQ a little bit less than that at 0.9% on the latest figures. So investors aren't buying this, and it's sort of like that cartoon where the guy's saying this is fine and there's a bunch of fire behind him because it obviously isn't. And I'd also note, Kim, that I think an apt phrase for this situation is that's used a lot in national security world is that there are black swans and pink flamingos. A black swan is something that you don't see coming, a random event that's hard to control. And then there are pink flamingos that are things that everyone should see coming and that are hiding in plain sight. I think this is the latter. It's a pink flamingo. And the question is why regulators didn't see it coming after we have Congress spending excessively and the Fed holding rates at near negative interest for a long time. We knew there would be vulnerabilities as they started to increase rates. And the large question is why regulators missed it. And I don't think we're getting an answer to that question. And I think it may be feeding into why it's hard to credit Yellen on this tour telling everybody that everything is okay.
Yeah, I agree with you, Kate. I think one of the more interesting things that we should be watching, and I saw yesterday that Senator Ted Cruz, his committee in Congress, launching investigations, specifically looking into Fed actions here and how these banks, which are supposed to be performing these regular stress tests, et cetera, why this was not flagged sooner. But, you know, Alicia, the other thing that was really striking to me about Yellen's testimony yesterday was that she also made the claim that the government's decision to backstop depositors at SVC and Signature did not qualify as a bailout. And yet there's a lot of suspicion out there that not only was that a bailout, but the politics played a role potentially both in that bailout and in the question of why regulators weren't more engaged here. Let's listen to Senator John Cornyn talk about one aspect of that, the regulators in that committee testimony yesterday.
Some have suggested that this was an example of mismanagement at a time of higher interest rates and higher inflation. Others are saying, where are the regulators? Were they asleep at the wheel? Many have suggested that banking regulators need to focus more on regulating banks, protecting depositors and taxpayers instead of straying off course and examining so-called climate-related risks and other social engineering goals. I think these are all fair points.
You know, Alicia, it strikes me as two things here dealing with politics. First, this question that the senator just posed of oversight and whether or not the San Francisco Fed chief, Mary Daly, and her team were really looking at risk enough, or whether they had been sidelined by climate issues. You know, did they purposely turn a blind eye in particular to the question of SVB, given that it was sort of the darling lender of all of these clean tech and climate initiatives startups that were out there? I think the other thing, though, is the question of the bailout itself. The loudest demands for all that came from Governor Gavin Newsom in California, Silicon Valley politicians, venture capitalists, who, by the way, happen to be big Democratic donors. Was this, in fact, a bailout? Was SVB bailed out for political reasons? Did he get in this situation because of politics too, and green initiatives and the climate craze?
So I don't think there's any doubt that this is, or question about this being a bailout. There's a reason that the insurance limit for the FDIC is $250,000. That was intended to protect small depositors. And the FDIC, actually, its reserve isn't large enough to cover all the uninsured deposits. So essentially what they're doing is unprecedented. Usually a bank is sold off, and then those, sometimes the uninsured deposits will get covered. But here the government is saying, you know, preemptively that we've got your back. Now, in terms of the bank management and the politics of all this, I'm sure it's hard to doubt that the bank's importance to Silicon Valley in terms of funding, or half of venture capital companies bank with Silicon Valley, and they got very generous loan terms. And the bank was known to be very accommodative in terms of, like, when startups couldn't make debt payments, they often, you know, extended the maturity of the loans or the credit lines. And a lot of these startups, by the way, are involved in green energy. I think the bank said that there were about 1,500 climate and sustainability startups that it did business with. And so that seems to may have caused the regulators, especially the San Francisco Fed, which is in charge of supervising this bank, and actually was in charge of supervising First Republic and some other banks that now appear to have trouble, may have turned a blind eye, as you say. I mean, it's a focus. If you just go to its website, it's astonishing. It's much more interested in, like, in regulating the climate and making sure that the banks are appropriate risk management in terms of managing their climate exposure, which doesn't really present a near-term, immediate, or really material risk to their balancing sheets than they are to managing other material financial risks, such as the rising interest rates. And why the Fed bank examiners didn't notice this, or if they did, they didn't say anything. I mean, that's going to be a subject for a congressional investigation. But I think, you know, Ted Cruz on the Commerce Committee has started raising this issue. Interestingly, Pat Toomey, who was the Pennsylvania senator who was the former ranking member on the banking committee, he retired this year. But last year, he was actually beating the drum on the San Francisco Fed's descent into woke politics, how it seemed way too focused on climate in particular, but also diversity and inclusion. And it seemed to have lost its way and forgotten what it's there to do.
Yeah, a lot of examining yet to be done on the examiners. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, a little bit more on the Washington response to this banking mess, and also the real story on insulin prices when we come back.
We've all felt left out. And for people who move to this country, that feeling lasts more than a moment. We can change that. Learn how at belongingbeginswithus.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council.
Don't forget, you can reach the latest episode of Potomac Watch anytime. Just ask your smart speaker, play the Opinion Potomac Watch podcast.
From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
Welcome back. I'm Kim Strassel. I'm here with Kate Batchelder Odell and Alicia Finley. Kate, just one last quick question on this banking situation. A little bit of news coming out of Washington from the president. We've had politicians all over the map on what the congressional response should be here. And now in walks President Biden, and he is calling on Congress to pass legislation that would put bank managers on the hook when banks fail. And I'll just read the key section here. The statement says, when banks fail due to mismanagement and excessive risk-taking, it should be easier for regulators to claw back compensation from executives, to impose civil penalties, and to ban executives from working in the industry again, end quote. Look, I get that there's no question that the banks look to have failed to adequately manage their risk here, but it strikes me that this, much as we kind of saw in 2008, it's kind of a call for federal authorities to ignore their own role in this, namely banking regime set up under the Dodd-Frank law that encouraged banks to invest in exactly the kind of securities that they're now getting punished for, given higher interest rates. And also, by the way, those higher interest rates brought on by excessive government spending and poor monetary policy. Is this a bill that is just going to do anything or matter if it were to pass, or is just a chance for everyone to pile on bank execs?
Yeah, Kim, I was really struck by the phrase excessive risk-taking. Pat Toomey, as Leisha mentioned, was on CNBC earlier this week putting on a clinic about how the Fed forced banks up the risk curve with their policies. So that is fundamentally part of the story of how we got here. Now, I'd love to say this is pure misdirection, and it certainly looks like it, but to bail out the banks and then roll out this demagoguery about bank managers looks designed to compromise the public's confidence in capitalism. Perhaps that's a little too cynical on my part, but it simply doesn't look like they want to talk about the underlying realities here. I mean, Toomey was saying, raised a good point, he knows a lot about this from being on banking, but bank regulators are, quote, nearly omnipotent. They have a lot of insight into what's going on at banks, and they didn't see any of this coming. So I think Biden administration doesn't want to have that conversation, and so they are throwing up whatever they can think of.
Yeah. And by the way, we embrace cynicism here on the Potomac Watch podcast. So that's good. Let's change gears here real quick. Sanofi, which is a major European drug maker, says that it plans to make a 78% list price reduction on Lantus, which is the company's most widely used insulin in the U.S., and a 70% cut on another product that it has, an insulin product, starting early next year. Sanofi said that its Lantus costs, out-of-pocket costs, would be capped at $35 a patient a month. And its head of U.S. general medicine was quoted as saying, no one should struggle to pay for their insulin. And this is one of the largest makers of insulin. But also we had Eli Lilly recently and Novo Nordic both say they would slash insulin prices. Alicia, Democrats have been all over this issue of late, pressuring drug makers to cut insulin costs. The president banged on about it in the State of the Union. Democrats even resorted to a bit of a warning and coercion last year in their Inflation Reduction Act, where they included a provision capping out-of-pocket insulin payments for Medicare patients. But we had a really good editorial recently, Alicia, pointing out that this is really kind of pure fiction, this line. Most people aren't actually struggling to pay for their insulin. Can you tell us what's really going on?
So in actuality, about 3 out of 4 people already pay less than $35 for their insulin. What's going on is this is a somewhat wonky issue, but what happens is insulin makers have been raising their list prices, which is essentially what the top line price without other rebates and discounts. And they negotiate these rebates with pharmaceutical benefit managers that work with insurers. And the rebates from the insulin makers to the insurers actually dramatically reduce the cost to the insurers. These rebates are actually ended up being spread across all insurance customers and help reduce premiums. So insulin costs, the top line price actually has increased in recent years, but the net price that's actually paid is actually pretty much flat. The people who really get harmed by this gap are people who don't have insurance and have to pay out of pocket for insulin, or people who have very high deductibles. Now, increasingly, insurers are offering to cover insulin at low copays below the deductible because of the high price. These list prices can actually, you know, discourage people from actually using the drug and make it. And so there's actually a health benefit for making this available below the deductible limit. And Kate has written a bunch on this in over the years, but it's just a fiction that insulin prices have been increasing.
Yeah, I mean, it's fascinating, everything you just said, because it is not what you ever hear coming out of Washington. You know, to listen to the president, there are most Americans are struggling to pay their insulin costs. Speaking of those politicians, the drug makers understand that they are on the political menu here, and they are responding to pressure that you're getting from a lot of these high-profile Democrats, including these kind of threats. You know, that was a warning shot back in the Inflation Reduction Act. We can do this with government Medicare prices, and, you know, we're going to come after you in some other way unless you get on board with our agenda. But as we all know, especially, and we talk about here a lot on this podcast, when government wanders into markets to artificially set prices or caps on products, things rarely turn out as planned. There are usually some sort of unexpected consequences or market distortions. So now we've got these drug makers responding to this political pressure, and they're slashing prices for one drug. But what do you see happening here? I mean, what could be some of those unexpected consequences and fallout from this move?
Right, Kim. So to Alicia's point, the high prices that a few people do pay for insulin is largely a curiosity in how we run insurance, not the list price of the drug. Basically, if Congress were to set a $35 out-of-pocket cap on the drug, as they are threatening to do, and as most companies are already trying to move toward a model where most people get that anyway, the difference will be buried among the drug supply chain. The drug makers will try to stick it on the insurers or back and forth. But I think there are reasons to worry about this because for two reasons. One is that it may send a signal to investors that diabetes is not a good drug category to invest in because it is too easy a political target. Joe Biden has been talking about insulin specifically for months and uses it as a convenient political example because it has some dysfunction and because it's a drug that a lot of Americans need. So it makes for what he thinks is a good political narrative. But I worry about sending capital out of those categories, out of better insulins that control blood sugar better, out of other blood sugar medicines or diabetes devices, et cetera. But I think the even bigger risk here, Kim, is that what the Biden administration is doing is not limited to insulin. We saw in the Inflation Reduction Act that the Biden administration wants to control the price of and access to all new drugs. The drugs that really should give everyone pause is the ones that Alicia has written on so fluidly, which are, for instance, an Alzheimer's drug, a new drug that is going to be expensive because the cost of developing a drug like that is so astronomical and includes the drugs that never make it through testing and development. So the drugs that the Biden administration wants to control really are new in class drugs in areas where there may be no other treatments. We have already seen the Inflation Reduction Act cause some companies to abandon some cancer drugs that no longer make sense under the price ceilings that the Biden administration is setting. So it's really not just about insulin, though the consequences may be negative there. This is really about all drug development and whether drug makers can get a return on their investment.
Yeah, and the victims here are going to be an American population that's getting older and is going to need those drugs too. Thank you, Kate. Thank you, Alicia. We thank our listeners. We remind you that we are here every weekday. We'll be back on Monday. You can email us at pwpodcast@wsj.com. And if you like this show, please hit the subscribe button.